We are live here today on Friday, June 26th, and I appreciate people bearing with me at a slightly earlier live recording time today. Of course, if you're listening to this on the podcast, you're not going to know the difference, but Paul graciously agreed to do the show with me a little bit earlier this week because I'm going to hop to watch Trump's speech at the Faith and Freedom, I think it's Faith and Freedom Coalition or something like that. It's the Ralph Reed organization, who's kind of a name from the pre-Trump days, but I try to watch most Trump speeches, in this one in particular, because, you know, whenever Trump gives speeches to Christian groups, it kind of lays bare how unchristian he is. There was an evangelical group that he spoke to earlier this year where we did a whole piece on the newsletter about how he's kind of playing his evangelical supporters for suckers by sort of making a mockery of their religion and sort of pretending to be religious. So thank you, Paul, for that. I guess I want to start with, there was kind of a high profile Trump speech this week that I did not watch because I went to see Shohei Ohtani pitch against my Minnesota Twins. But that was the speech that Trump gave along the National Mall nearby the cursed reflecting pool in D.C. to commemorate the beginning of the 250th birthday of America celebrations. Paul, did you happen to tune into that? It seems like that was one of the speeches where a lot of people who don't watch a lot of Trump did tune in, which made me feel bad for not watching it. So I'm curious if you watched.
You know, I have to admit, I only saw snippets. And it seemed in a lot of ways like a sort of an ordinary Trump speech. But what was weird is that they didn't seem to promote the event all that much. And according to the reports I saw, there were like maybe 1,000 people there. I saw videos of people kind of streaming out as he was talking. And that's kind of, remarkable. I think we may have said on a previous episode that sometimes it seems like, you know, Trump may be a showman, but he doesn't always put on a great show. And I guess Lee Greenwood was there, which, of course, and he made some remarks about, or I guess, no, it was Sean Duffy,
yes,
the Secretary of Transportation, who said something about how, you know, they're not going to have like the libtards, the libtard performers weren't invited after all. I guess, you know, this event just was not big enough for Milli Vanilli and a guy who used to be in CNC Music Factory. But it really just seemed like kind of a low energy situation, despite the flyover, the fighter jets and stuff like that.
Well, and it was very funny because the Duffy speech that you mentioned, I did after the fact go back and rewatch good chunks of it. Not the Duffy part, but I did see the big clips from it. And, on one hand, he had this remark about, like you said, I think he was referring to the Marine Band, who was forced to stand behind both Duffy and Trump throughout their speeches, but he was talking to them and said, you know, you're way better than the libtards who canceled or something like that. But then in the same speech, you know, he was talking about how, young people have been pursuing fame on social media and kind of fleeting gratifications. And, you know, now they're going to church to find God. And he even had a remark to the Marine Band about how Trump will make you famous. The whole thing was very incoherent where, you know, on one hand, he's talking about libtards. On the other hand, he's talking about, you know, the yearning that people have for spirituality and going back to church and all this stuff. So I thought that kind of laid bare, you know, some of the contradictions of Trumpism. And, you know, I saw someone in the comments here, and I should mention at the top here that if you are a paid subscriber to Public Notice, you can leave comments in the chat or ask us questions, and we'll get to them as we go. And this one was from Sherry, who said, no way 45,000 people were there, which I believe is in reference to Trump's Truth Social post, where I think he quoted a crowd size of 45,000 for his event on Wednesday night, which of course gave me flashbacks to one of the first Trump events that I remember kind of live posting about was the Sean Spicer press conference, the first day of Trump's presidency in 2017, where he had the infamous remark about how that was the largest crowd to witness an inauguration, period, full stop, even though it clearly wasn't. So, you know, the playbook kind of remains the same there. But it was one of those confusing things, Paul, because, you know, on TV, which I think is how most people consumed the event, you could see that it was pretty sparse and that they had kind of this pen set up for a huge crowd that didn't materialize. But then if you looked at some of the photographs, like kind of the area behind Trump was pretty full, you know, certainly looked like more than 1,000, you know, who of his diehard fans who were there for kind of the rally aspect. So, you know, it's one of those things that kind of depends, I think, how you look at it, but they clearly were expecting a much bigger crowd than materialized. And a lot of the coverage the next day was about kind of, I think one headline even had the word dismal, you know, a dismal crowd, you know, receiving Trump for his speech. And you're also right that Trump basically only does one speech. He's only capable of kind of doing the same speech over and over. So sometimes the setting can be notable, like when he speaks to Christian groups, because the content of his speech is very un-Christian. But, you know, he was hyping just before he went live a similar speech that he's doing on July 4th. That will feature like a flyover and whatnot in DC. And I may skip that one too, because even myself, you know, a decade into this, I'm getting a little burned out with the fact that all the speeches are kind of the same.
Yeah. And, you know, he's really not good at the sort of unifying rituals that presidents are often called upon to perform. And he just can't bear to make something like that nonpartisan. Yeah. And, you know, that is something that we expect from presidents, that there are certain kind of occasions where they're going to be partisan, and then there are others when they're supposed to be acting as the president of the whole of America, the whole country. And Trump just can't bring himself to do that. And so whenever they try to, you know, convince people that this is actually going to be something that's for everyone and is something, you know, for honoring the country's 250th birthday, that he just can't do it. And I think people know that he can't. And the same impulse to kind of keep his supporters close ends up pushing everybody else away. And so over time, that group kind of gets smaller and smaller. You know, for a long time, we sort of marveled at how it is that he keeps, you know, he does so many of these rallies and he always has these diehard fans. And one of the things that came out is that it's a lot of the same people. They kind of follow him around like he's the dead or the fish, excuse me. And, you know, and just like at a dead show, you know, they're not wearing like dancing bears and tie dyes, but they're wearing the MAGA gear. They have these emblems of identity, but it's a lot of the same people. But even now, you know, 10 years in, how many of these are you going to go to? I think even the most committed Trump people, like, you know, you've seen the show before. You've heard all the, you know, you've heard him play all the hits, and it doesn't have as much appeal. And for anyone else who might consider it, you know, what are you going to, why are you going to bother going to something like that? I think a lot of people are just like, yeah. And so he is so, all that focus on keeping hold of the base ends up alienating people. And that makes it harder for him to do these kinds of events in ways that will draw more people in, as most presidents are able to, at least every once in a while.
Yeah, you're right. And another notable aspect was that Fox News on the night of that speech, which was Wednesday night, they were doing full on, you know, live coverage the whole evening. They had Laura Ingraham and Hannity, you know, they had their production areas kind of nearby where the speech was. And, you know, they had like really big production values for it. Like it was this huge event. And, you know, you could imagine in a parallel universe where like if Kamala Harris had won the election, where she probably would have done a nonpartisan speech and they would have had musical entertainment that wasn't Lee Greenwood and the Marine Band. And maybe that would have been broadcast by like, you know, CBS, ABC, the networks. But, you know, Trump is so toxic that no one would touch it. I mean, even CNN, I don't think, carried it live, nor did MS Now. So, you know, it was basically Fox. I'm sure Newsmax had it. But yeah, I mean, because people know that he can't unify people and that he can't help but be very partisan and kind of demeaning, he does the same speech every time. No one even really thinks of, you know, covering these things at this point. So, you know, that does kind of, I think, box him in a little bit appeal-wise, but, you know, I think we're kind of past that point. I don't think anybody's really expecting Trump to kind of broaden his coalition at this point.
Yeah, it really isn't. And he is, I think, doing fewer rallies than he used to. And so I think that may be a product of him maybe being a little tired. He does seem to be kind of cocooning in the White House. I think maybe at some level they also know that they just can't produce something that's going to be really epic, you know? And so maybe every once in a while you can have something novel like, oh, it's going to be a UFC fight. But other than that, just another Trump rally is not something that the press is going to pay much attention to. And it's not something that you're going to get a lot of people to be super excited about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say, as a Minneapolis guy who has been a longtime fan of Morris Day and the Time, I was a little bit dismayed when they announced the lineup initially for that event on Wednesday night, and Morris Day and the Time was initially included, which, you know, his whole gimmick over the years has been kind of get your money, get your bag. So I wouldn't have been totally shocked had they partaken. And then it came out, of course, that I think like a lot of the artists, they were sold a bit of a bill of goods where they thought it was going to be, you know, not a Trump rally, or that, you know, it'd be less partisan than it was shaping up to be. And so they backed out. And, you know, I think that kind of set the stage for just being sort of a Fox News special. But to kind of pivot from there, you know, talking about Trump limiting his appeal and, you know, not really caring to reach out beyond his base, you know, I thought another notable development, you know, which is kind of the focus of today's episode and was the headline, Trump Takes Housing, is this housing bill that he tanked earlier in the day on Wednesday before the 250th event. And Paul, I'm not sure if you followed this as close as I did, but it was truly remarkable. And I posted clips as this was going on where the House Republicans were having their weekly press conference, which they clearly pegged to Trump's signing event for this bill. Now, you know, I read up a little bit on the actual, maybe to start with the contents of the bill itself. And, you know, there were a lot of headlines about how this was like the biggest housing bill in a generation. I can't really speak to that. You know, it seemed to me like it was a lot of, you know, kind of incrementalist, you know, making mortgages slightly more affordable or restricting or, you know, loosening zoning restrictions so that you could build more housing and, you know, changing the definition of like what a manufactured home is to make them more readily available. So, you know, there weren't any like real sexy items in this bill, but, you know, it seems like experts in the space thought that it would be an improvement and would, you know, presumably over time bring down the cost of housing. And obviously affordability is kind of the watchword, you know, for all politicians across the political spectrum. And I think you saw that in how bipartisan this bill was, where you only had five Republican senators, kind of like the lunatic fringe of the you know, Republican caucus who didn't vote for it. It was kind of similar in the House, where Republicans, you know, from center right, you know, to the more center factions all voted for this. And so you had, you know, the spectacle of House Republicans holding their news conference. You had French Hill, who was one of the authors of the bill in the House, literally on stage as Trump's True Social post drops, announcing that, you know, this is a minor bill and he's not signing it because he's demanding that the Save America Act be passed before he'll sign this into law. And, you know, so it just really was kind of a reminder that, you know, it's not just rhetoric when Trump talks about he doesn't care about affordability and he doesn't care about Americans' financial situation. Like, this is a real thing. And it seems like his beef with the bill in terms of the content of it is that he's of the idea that the only thing that matters for housing is interest rates. And so, you know, it seems like he's trying to kind of get a twofer here. He's trying to pressure the Fed to lower rates, which, you know, Kevin Warsh, the new Fed chair, has indicated that, you know, he just seems super keen on doing in the short run. And then also he wants this Save America Act, which, you know, seems to be kind of like a Republican election rigging bill. You know, it's not totally clear what exactly it would do. The two main provisions are requiring voter ID and then, you know, requiring some sort of demonstration of proof of citizenship for registration. Now, it seems DOA in the Senate because they don't have 60 votes to pass it and they don't have 50 votes to get rid of the filibuster, you know, in which case they could pass the Save America Act with 50. But Paul, I'm just wondering if, as you were watching this unfold, like what this made you think about in terms of, you know, is this really just an example? This is where my mind went of, you know, Trump just being kind of beyond the reach of normal political incentives at this point. And it seems like he's kind of given up on traditional politics of, like, you know, gaining support by doing positive things for people. And it's all kind of using leverage to, you know, try to bully his way into entrenching GOP power. Was that kind of your read as well?
Yeah. And I think it highlighted the division right now between him and Republican members of Congress. Like, he just does not care about them and they know it. And, you know, this is a bill, like, it wasn't earth shattering, but it's still, I think it's still notable that you got Republicans and Democrats to agree to something. You know, it has some things about, oh, you know, we're going to streamline some permitting and things like that. And there was a thing in there about people are worried about private equity firms buying up houses. And so there's some limits on how many housing units one corporate entity can own. Nothing about it was too earth shaking. And it was, like, you know, reasonable enough that Republicans and Democrats both were like, okay, we can do this. And I think for Republicans, you know, they wanted to show that they're actually doing something. And I think it's not just that this is a big problem and, you know, it's something that everybody is worried about is the cost of housing. But, you know, right now they're all campaigning for reelection. And I think one of the critiques that Democrats can offer and one of the questions that just voters will have is like, what are you there for? You know, because Congress is not doing anything as far as people can see. And this is a product of the Trump era. Like, he just doesn't really care about legislation. I mean, first of all, it's just too much of a hassle for him. You know, if you think about what it takes to pass an ambitious bill, that is complicated. You know, you have to balance all these competing interests and you have to understand what different members of Congress want. And you have these different factions, even within the Republican Party, the Freedom Caucus, and the more moderate people. And, you know, it's really complicated. And Trump has never been down for that at all. Basically, he passed one big bill in his first term, which was a tax cut, and then one big bill in his second term, which was a tax cut. And he didn't really have much involvement in that. Like, you know, the congressional negotiators, they worked it out. It wasn't like he was somebody like Biden or even Obama was during Obamacare, like being on the phone and talking to different members and convincing them. You know, it's just not his thing. And that leaves them in a difficult position because now they have to go back to their districts and say, like, look what I'm doing for you. And the natural question is, like, you don't seem to be doing anything. What are you doing? And so this was something that they could at least say, like, look, housing is a problem. I know everybody's worried about it. And so we passed this bill. And even if it isn't going to have any short-term effect on people's lives, at least it was something they could tell their voters. And then Trump comes in and he's basically like, I don't give a crap, you know?
Yeah.
And so you have the situation where they are, I think the Republican members are feeling like they're really being hung out to dry by him.
Yeah.
And so that was the thing that really stuck out to me is just, yeah, it really illustrated this divide between him and the people in his own party. And maybe he doesn't appreciate that he's going to really be affected if they lose one or both houses. But he doesn't seem to be working very hard to try to keep hold of those, of that power.
Well, I think he realizes that he's going to be affected, but it seems to me that he thinks the Save America Act is kind of the solution to this, you know, and maybe that is, you know, a reflection of the fact that his numbers are so far gone. And, you know, I mean, he doesn't really have an affordability agenda or, you know, a constructive economic agenda. And, you know, so, I mean, maybe that is just his response to political incentives of trying to maintain power is that he thinks, you know, by vote suppression, essentially, he can get there. And, you know, it was notable, I think, some of the dynamics that you mentioned in terms of hanging Republicans out to dry. We saw a little inkling of that where, you know, Trump on that same day, Wednesday, after he announced that he wasn't signing the housing bill, he went over to have lunch with Senate Republicans. And as we learned later, got into a shouting match with Bill Cassidy, which isn't totally shocking given that, you know, Trump essentially ended his career by endorsing his competitor in the primary and Cassidy went on to lose. But the thing that really stuck out to me was that he did a brief press gaggle after the lunch with John Thune, the majority leader standing next to him. And Paul, I'm not sure if you saw some of the images from this, but Thune was basically rolling his eyes, you know, as Trump was speaking and, you know, kind of making faces. And then Trump sort of abruptly, he took a question or two and wrapped it up and sort of huffed away. And Thune, instead of, you know, walking Trump out of the Capitol, walked the opposite direction to kind of get away from him. You know, and Thune has been out there, you know, kind of taking the heat for the fact that there aren't the votes in the Senate to get rid of the filibuster, which it seems like is necessary to pass the Save America Act because they don't have 60 votes. Obviously, you need some Democrats and they're not going to go along. You know, maybe Fetterman would, but you're not going to have seven of them go along with the Save America Act. So, you know, I thought that was notable. You know, it is still kind of annoying that, you know, we have to give John Thune credit for like rolling his eyes. And that's kind of as far as it goes, that he won't, you know, make a public statement that's a little bit more less passive aggressive and more direct in terms of his frustrations with Trump. But, you know, I did think that was notable and probably a reflection that there's some frustration that this would have been a tangible win that they could have brought back to constituents. And they don't have it now. And so now they have to sweat it out, where we have to wait and see. You know, the way that, and Paul, maybe you know more about this than I do, but when a bill is passed by both chambers of Congress, if the president doesn't sign it in 10 days, it becomes law. Now, there are some sort of caveats to that where I believe that if the House is in recess after the 10 days, it's like a pocket veto, basically.
Right.
Or if the bill is never presented to the president by the House Speaker, that's kind of like another sort of form of pocket veto. Now, I did see that Johnson did present the bill to Trump, so that starts a 10-day clock. I think that happened yesterday. Right. But there is some reporting that, you know, the House is not scheduled to be in session in 10 days. And so I don't totally know how that, you know, untangling all that, what that means. It would be hard to imagine Trump vetoing the bill, but maybe he would. And then, you know, you wonder if Republicans are so cowed by him at this point that even though they had these huge margins, veto-proof majorities for this bill, you know, would enough of them not want to cross Trump where maybe it wouldn't pass with the same margin the second time? So what's your understanding of how that plays over the 10 day period that we're in now? And how confident are you that this housing bill, despite Trump's intransigence, will become law?
Yeah, I think you described it accurately. So it can become law without his signature.
Yeah.
And I don't think we know if he wants to veto it. It's kind of unclear. Like, it seems like he just doesn't really care. Like, he doesn't not want this bill to become law. It's not something he's opposed to. But he is so focused on the SAVE Act that if he really thought that he could get the SAVE Act with threats, then maybe he would veto it. But that's not clear either. And this is one of those cases where it's a little hard to get into his mind. Like, does he really believe that the SAVE Act is, you know, it's in reach, and it would, I think he said once, like, if we pass this, we'll never lose another election.
Yes.
Which is kind of, you know, saying the quiet part out loud, right? Does he really believe that? Or is it just kind of like something that he likes to talk about because he wants to talk about voter fraud? It's not really clear. And I'm sure that they must have communicated to him that the SAFE Act is just not going to happen. And so where does that leave him? I don't know. Maybe he thinks he can pressure them into it. So as you said, like, it seems like hard to believe that he would actually go ahead and veto the housing bill. But in that case, maybe he'll just let the 10 days expire and Congress will, you know, make sure they don't go out of session, which is that calendar is up to the, you know, it's up to the speaker and the leader. And so they can make sure that they stay in session for however long is necessary for it to become law. So I think that's probably the most likely outcome. But, you know, the other thing about this is that I think Johnson, more than Thune, is just not really good at this whole legislating, managing the Congress thing. You know, I think Thune is like, he has a lot of loyalty among Republicans in the Senate, and they feel like, you know, he does as good a job as possible managing Trump. They like him. They'll stand by him. You know, he's not like a kind of an arm-twisting, threaten your life kind of guy like Mitch McConnell may have been at times. He got a lot of loyalty too. But, you know, I don't, it seems like Speaker Johnson has really never shown any particular skill at his job, which admittedly is very difficult. You know, he's got these razor thin majority. And a lot of people in that caucus who, you know, really don't care. Like, they are bomb throwers. And this is something, you know, we could get into later when we talk about the New York election. Like, the people on the fringe of the Republican Party in the House, especially, like, they are happy to have chaos. Like, if things don't pass and there are shutdowns, like, that's fine with them. And that makes them very difficult to deal with. And so, but Johnson is, you know, he just doesn't have the juice of somebody who really is skilled, like, say, Nancy Pelosi was, at keeping the caucus together and achieving, you know, one goal after another to keep things moving. He's just kind of sort of, you know, treading water frantically, trying to keep his head above water. So that doesn't bode well for how this is all going to turn out.
Yeah, I mean, he did wrangle people well enough to get the big, beautiful bill done last year, which was no sure thing at the time. People thought the votes might not be there for that. So, and it seemed like that was as far, you know, as we talked about or touched upon earlier, that was the only bill Trump really seemed to care about, you know, until the Save America Act. So, you know, and he does have, not only does he have to manage his caucus, Mike Johnson, but he also has to manage Trump, you know, which is a big part of it, and kind of, you know, massaging his ego and making sure he's on side with him at all times, which, you know, can be challenging to kind of triangulate in that way. I'm curious, before we pivot to the New York topic and primaries more broadly, what's your level of concern with the Save America Act? Because I still don't really know totally how to think about this. I mean, it seems quite clear to me what the intention of it is. But we're also in a spot now where, you know, the election is, what, like 4 months away? You know, how sweeping of changes? Could you really implement national voter ID in 4 months? I kind of doubt it. So I don't really know. I don't feel like Republicans have been totally transparent with what their objectives are here, but I think we can kind of surmise what they are. So, I mean, just how concerned are you? And, you know, are you at all surprised that Republicans can't find the votes? Because I a little bit am that, with all the cajoling from Trump, that there aren't 50 votes among the Republican senators to get rid of the filibuster, because that, you know, it takes a little bit of like an institutionalist prerogative that I wouldn't think is still there at this late date of Trumpism. But it seems like there are at least, you know, I guess it would take four Republican senators who are not willing to get rid of the filibuster. So that is, I guess, you know, a small handful, and Trump has made some enemies. But, you know, so what are your thoughts on those two points, the level of concern with Save America and then the fact that there aren't the votes there to get rid of the filibuster?
Yeah, I think you're right that it would seem impossible. I mean, a having to prove your citizenship to register to vote. I mean, there are tens of millions of people who can't do that. Like, I'm sure everyone watching, half the people, if you said, where is your birth certificate? They'd have to be like, I'm not really sure. Is it at my parents' house? I don't know. And, you know, there are tens of millions of people who do not have passports. I can't remember the figure, but it's something like half of Americans don't have a passport. You have a question of people who took their spouse's name, mostly women. There are tens of millions of those who the name that's on their birth certificate is not the name that's on their driver's license. And under this bill, that would mean you couldn't register without being able to prove it. Like, it's would cause such upheaval that at a minimum, you'd have a lot of lawsuits that would tie it up in the courts for a while. So it would seem impossible that they could actually pass it and then implement it by November. Now, long term, it could be a problem if it were actually passed and would cause a certain amount of chaos. But you're right. Sometimes it's hard to tell if the Republicans who are supporting this are like, is it just kind of for a talking point so they can keep talking about voter fraud? And that may be part of it in that, you know, the whole party basically has gotten on board with the idea that there is dramatic and widespread fraud that has swung elections. And some of them may talk about 2020 slightly differently than others. You know, there are some Republicans who, when they get asked by reporters, they're like, well, you know, there's some shady stuff going on out there. We just don't know. And so they're, you know, they kind of give it an implicit endorsement without coming out and saying
yes,
that Joe Biden didn't win in 2020. But you don't find anybody who speaks the actual truth, which is that voter fraud is an absolutely infinitesimally small problem. And all of these things are much, much worse. We create many more problems than actually just leaving things basically the way they are. With perhaps, you know, maybe providing some more funding so local election boards can operate more efficiently and quickly. Like, that would be a good thing. But I think in terms of the filibuster, that fundamentally Republicans understand the argument that I've made in favor of filibuster reform is that over the long term, if you get rid of the filibuster, that helps Democrats more than Republicans. Even if right now they can say, well, we'd like to do these three things. They know that since Democrats are the party that is in favor of government and wants government to do a lot of stuff, that if you get rid of the filibuster, that means the next time Democrats have a trifecta, that they're going to pass a lot of things and they're going to be very consequential things. And so even though when there's a Republican president, the filibuster helps Democrats stop that Republican from doing bad things, there are many more things that Democrats want to do when they get the power. And so I think that's why, even if Republicans are frustrated, you're not going to get most of them to say, yes, let's blow it up now, because then, you know, come, let's say, 2029, potentially, you know, they're going to watch as Democrats just kind of go to town. Yeah. So, well, you know, yeah. I think that's what's at the heart of their opposition now.
I just want to, on that point, you know, I think part of the confusion for me is that when you watch these Republican senators, when they go on Fox or Newsmax or Steve Bannon's show, they all, you know, they all say that they support ending the filibuster, but then they, you know, and the next breath it's, well, the votes aren't there. And so I just kind of wonder, you know, it only takes four, but whoever they are, they're not going out publicly and saying that they don't support getting rid of the filibuster. So it's just strange in that respect, because if you just took at face value these media hits, you would think that they all support it. Now, you know, not all the 53 are on TV all the time. So it was probably a group of about 20 that are, you know, very active and doing kind of, you know, some of them almost daily TV hits, but many of them, you know, once a week, every couple of weeks. But I would just like to know, you know, who these four are that are holding out, because I guess they do deserve some credit. It would be obviously much worse right now if they got rid of the filibuster, although I guess, Paul, you know, to longer term, obviously, probably healthy for our democracy and good for Democrats if Republicans, you know, took that step, because then it would be kind of carte blanche next time Dems do have a trifecta, which could be as soon as 2029. So, you know, I can see that part of it, too. But, you know, if the idea is to ram through the Save America Act ahead of the midterms, in the short run, I think at least that would be very bad.
Yeah. And, you know, also the filibuster has also helped them kind of constrain their worst instincts. I think this is how Mitch McConnell often thought about it, is like, you could give people kind of a show vote to say, OK, let's outlaw abortion nationally. And that satisfies the, you know, the right wing of the party. But they don't have to actually do it. And they could say, well, you know, wish we could have done it, but it was the filibuster. And then they don't have to deal with the political consequences of doing unpopular things. So that serves a function for them too.
Yeah. Well, let's pivot for the remainder of the show here to talking about, you know, the other big political story. There were a few this week, but the primaries that took place on Tuesday and, you know, the big headlines coming out of it were the ascendant DSA faction in New York State, particularly around New York City, where Mamdani went 3-for-3 with his endorsements in primaries, including, you know, in at least one race where the Chevalier, who ended up ousting an incumbent in a primary, was not really expected to win until Mamdani got involved and made an endorsement in that race. But, you know, you've had a little bit of hand-wringing where, you know, I think Jamie Harrison's been the person who's been kind of most emblematic, the former DNC chair, where he had a tweet and then a post on Blue Sky, you know, basically kind of denouncing these DSA candidates. And, you know, he had some phrasing about how, like, you know, if you're going to run against the party, you don't have access to our resources, you know, sort of an us versus them, almost casting them as like sort of others or outsiders. And, you know, you address this in a piece in the cross section, which I highly recommend people read, with the headline, "The New York Election Proves That Primaries Are Good." You don't need to make the whole case here because I, you know, would recommend people go check out the piece. But, you know, Paul, maybe briefly, what is your case for primaries being good? I think there is obviously an idea that they can be kind of, you know, destructive and can result in candidates being kind of weakened heading into generals. But make the brief case for why primaries are actually healthy and good.
Yeah, I think this is irrespective of whether you like any particular candidate. And we saw in New York, you know, the three people that Mamdani endorsed and won their races, two of whom knocked off sitting members of Congress, there's a little bit of variety between them. You know, you got Brad Lander, who is somebody who's been a politician in New York for a long time. He's not like an upstart DSA member. He made himself out to be more progressive than Dan Goldman, who he beat. But, you know, and then you have on the other side Chevalier, who's very much one of those upstart DSA members and has a lot of, you know, controversial tweets and stuff. And maybe there's going to be people who don't like her. But the point is that, you know, this is the process. And I think a lot of the kind of establishment Democrats, like, they don't want messy primaries. They want to just be able to pick the person. This is what the DCCC does. You know, when there's a primary for a House race, they basically decide, okay, this is the person that we want and we think is the best suited to win the general election. And some of the reasons that they do that might be valid. Like, you know, we think they're appealing to a general election electorate. But a lot of it is just like, who's an insider, who can raise a lot of money from, you know, big donors, who are we comfortable with, who do we know? And so they want to basically like take out all the messiness. And my argument is that like the messiness is actually good. Like the messiness shows you who is a skilled candidate, a charismatic candidate who could generate excitement. And, you know, if your establishment candidate can do that, then great. But if they can't, then that shows that there was something wrong with them. And so, you know, you take a race like what's going on in the Michigan Senate race. Okay, so you have three big candidates there. Haley Stevens, who's a congresswoman. She is the establishment choice. She's the one who they want to win. And, you know, she's kind of a sort of a replacement level Democrat, not particularly progressive, not, you know, super conservative or anything. She's kind of in the middle of the party. She's not all that exciting. And maybe she'll win. But, you know, right now, Abdul El-Sayed is the lefty candidate, and he seems to be generating more excitement. And I've even seen some polls where he's leading. And you have Mallory McMorrow, who was someone who a lot of people were very excited about, but she seems to be in third. And, you know, it's like the proof is in the pudding. We're seeing how the three of them perform. And if, you know, if Stevens ends up winning, well, that will show that the establishment was right. But if El-Sayed ends up winning, like, that will show that they were wrong. And he's the most compelling candidate. And the same thing is true of New York. Like, I don't think that these members of Congress and the rest of the New York establishment really have a lot of grounds to complain. Like, if their candidates lost, well, you know, that's on them. Like, why didn't they do a better job? If these, you know, the people who were either first-time candidates or they were, you know, in the state assembly or something like that, like, they came in and they beat a sitting member of Congress, you know, that shows that there was something wrong with that sitting member of Congress. And, you know, that's how we got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She beat Joe Crowley, a longtime member who had kind of lost touch with his district, and the district changed over time, and he wasn't really representing that much anymore. And she came in and just like worked the shoe leather, and she won. And that's good. You know, you need that kind of turnover from time to time. And so I don't think that like all of these moderate Democrats were like, oh no, we've got all these crazy lefties, and now they're going to bring us down, and we have to come up with a way to fight them. If you go to Politico, they're really into this story. They've published like a half a dozen pieces on this. And you know, I just don't think that that's really worth your time. And I also don't think that those people are going to be, you know, crazy bomb throwers. Like they keep saying, like the Freedom Caucus of the left. But the big difference there is that the Freedom Caucus, as I said before, like those righties, they want to be destructive and they don't care if government does anything or not. The far left people, in contrast, like they want government to do stuff. And so they're going to try to get legislation passed. They're not going to try to shut down the government if they don't get, you know, single payer healthcare on the first week, because like they actually want more people to get healthcare. And so they're willing to compromise. So that's where I think people ought to just they celebrate primaries for being useful and productive.
Yeah, the one that I'm concerned about is Chevalier, just because you don't want to judge someone by their tweets. She was very active in some of the Columbia protests, which is fine. I mean, you know, but she called Joe Biden a rapist. She said COVID came from France. The New York Times had a write up of her tweets, which have since been scrubbed. That seemed pretty bad. And, you know, I think she said that she's matured. Granted, these tweets are not from that long ago, but she is relatively young. And, people in their 20s, mature. So, I'd be lying if I wasn't didn't acknowledge me a little bit concerned. Now, of course, there is a dynamic where if it wasn't her, Fox News would find some other Democrat, you know, to portray as like the tip of the spear for communism or something like that. But, there is a lot of material to work with her in particular. She wouldn't have been my cup of tea, but I guess we'll just kind of wait and see. And there is kind of the dynamic too, where, you know, Republicans have had these kind of far right bomb throwers in their caucus forever. And that's just kind of people just think that that's sort of a cost of doing business, or it's a normal part of GOP politics. And, you know, I mean, Dems to a lesser degree have too. But so I don't think it's the end of the world to have a member or two like that. And, you know, there's also the dynamic where these House elections happen every 2 years. So, you know, if it turns out that she's really out of step with her district, she might lose as soon as the next time around. But I didn't really have a great sense. Were you following her campaign close enough to know like what what put her over the top? Was it really as simple as Mamdani endorsing her? I've seen some criticism. I believe the person that she was running against is Espelot is his name, who I did not know a ton about. He was kind of a lower profile member. But so any insight that you have there would be useful to me in terms of what the actual key issues there that were that led to her victory.
Yeah, I can't say that I followed it super closely, but, you know, he's the chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, you know, kind of one of these old line machine politicians who's been around for a long time and, you know, didn't get anybody particularly excited. And this was the perfect time for something like this. You know, you've got an anti-incumbent year. You have a situation in New York where the left is super activated, where Mamdani's endorsement can make a big difference. And, you know, they aired this ad during the NBA finals with him and the three candidates he was endorsing on a basketball court. This was just like the perfect time. And if you were an incumbent, you really would have had to work hard to fend off that challenge. And it didn't seem like Espaillat did that. So, and I have to say, yeah, that like when I looked at some of her old tweets, I was, you know, it made me cringe too. But I think we should be wary of assuming that when Republicans are going to try to tie other people to, you know, the most radical member of Congress they can find, that actually works. There's a real assumption that if Republicans are saying it a lot, that must mean that it's persuading people. And that must mean that some Democrat running for office in Arizona is really being screwed over by their implicit association with whoever the new boogeyman is that the Republicans are trying to create. And I don't think there is a lot of evidence for that. You know, we saw this for so many years when journalists would say, oh, you know, Nancy Pelosi is a real problem for Democrats. If you just look at this, all over the country, Republicans are airing ads that say like Nancy Pelosi is terrible and Congressman so-and-so just votes with Pelosi. And like the fact that they aired a lot of those ads doesn't necessarily mean that those ads worked, that there actually were people who were changing their votes based on Nancy Pelosi. And I think in the same way, yeah, they're going to go on Fox News and scream a lot about these crazy radical socialists in New York. Is that going to change anyone's mind? Is that going to have any real political impact? It might, but I think we shouldn't assume that it does just because Republicans are saying it a lot.
No, I'm with you. And for I guess for me personally, you know, anybody who kind of fell for the Tara Reade stuff in 2019. Was that 2020? It might have been already 2020 by the time that she was out there with her story. I mean, it just seemed so obviously to be an op the whole way through that that does make me kind of skeptical of someone's character. However, again, you know, I think she was in her early 20s at that stage. It's crazy to reflect on, but that was over 6 years ago now that that stuff was going on. I think that was right around the time that COVID was first, you know, entering people's lexicon. So, you know, people do change. And I'm kind of with you. I mean, do you make any delineation with your defensive primaries between, you know, I think it's one thing for like really blue seats where you're going to have a Democrat, you know, the election pretty much is the primary. I mean, all these Democrats are going to win. And and there weren't a lot of these in the House, at least this cycle. But, you know, I could certainly see a dynamic where if you're in a more kind of purple seat, you know, taking on a challenger from the left who, you know, can win a primary, but then isn't suited to win a general. So, I mean, to me, it seems like it might be a little bit district, you know, context dependent in that way. Now, again, I can't think of any high profile examples this cycle where we had, you know, an entrenched member who lost, you know, who governed in a more centrist manner to like a lefty insurgent. But does that temper your analysis at all?
Yeah, it's different in every place.
Yeah.
And I think, first of all, right now, there's never been a better chance than this year for somebody who's like to the left of their districts to win. You know, you're seeing lots and lots of districts where Trump won by 10 points, by 15 points, where people are really vulnerable. So if some person is too far left, is going to win in a district like this, is going to be the time. But also, I think that still confers an obligation on the moderate, whoever it is, to really show and persuade people that they're the best candidate. And they can't just like ride in and be like, you know, I'm the most moderate person. Like, you have to go out there and prove it. And, you know, being a candidate is hard. And if somebody is going to run kind of a lackluster race and hope that they're going to get the nomination just because they're the less lefty person in sort of a centrist district, you know, that might be a pretty good indication that they're not going to do well in the general either. And so, you know, you really need good, strong, moderate candidates too. Like if the left person is the one who's generating all the excitement and is out there knocking on 1,000 doors every day, if they're the one doing that, then they deserve to win. And the moderates have to step up their game too. So, you know, I also think, you know, primary voters are not opposed to electability arguments. They think about it too. So, you know, you can convince them that the electability is what matters most, and that you're the person who's more electable because you're more moderate. Like, give that a shot. But I'm really a big advocate for candidates actually proving that they have the juice. And if you can't do that, then you don't deserve to win.
Yep. And, you know, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I know the primary to face Mike Lawler in his district was won by the more moderate Democrat in that district, not the further left one. It was a competitive primary. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think it always breaks down in terms of, you know, left and further left. Sometimes there are other qualities that people find to be important. And, you know, Lawler was actually sinking a lot of resources into trying to tank the woman who ended up winning the primary to face him. So, you know, that kind of backfired and was an example of maybe electability being a concern in that district in the primary. But we didn't even have time today to get into your piece about the reflecting pool, which we've covered in public notice as well. I believe, Paul, you live relatively close to D.C., right? Have you been down there to pay your respects to the,
you know,
pool or see what's going on?
I have not been at the pool lately, but apparently now it's all fenced off and you can't even get down there. So,
hey, if you put your hand in and got arrested, it'd be good for cross-section subscribers, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That'd bring
you
it
to elbow your way past through all the National Guard people who are just doing what they've been doing for months, which is just milling around. So it's a hard time.
Yeah, and I'm sure that Trump, you know, wants to, he doesn't want a big green pool for his big event on the 4th, which is already 8 days from now. So it seems like he's feeling the crunch, and they're probably dumping more chemicals into the pool today and killing the ducks, you know, which is sad. Anyway, you had that in the cross section. We had a piece in public notice about that as well. I think everybody kind of did the same piece on that. Yours was a little bit different. I think a lot of people are doing it as kind of like a metaphor for his presidency, which, you know, there's a lot of material there to work with, but the genre might be a little bit saturated at this point. But anyway, on that note, we'll wrap it up for today so I can watch Trump's speech to the Ralph Reed Group. But thank you to the nearly 1,000 people we had tuned in today. If you're not a subscriber to the Cross Section, Paul's wonderful Substack, I highly recommend it. And same with Public Notice. If you appreciate these chats that we do on Friday. And of course, Paul also contributes to Public Notice. And you're not yet a paid subscriber, I'd really appreciate your support. We will be off next Friday because it is July 3rd. And I hope people are doing other things and watching Substack Lives, although we greatly appreciate when you tune in when we do them. But we will be back the following week on the 10th for a new edition. And we'll see what the hellscape brings us to talk about between now and then. I'm sure we'll have a lot of new horrors to dissect. But Paul, appreciate talking with you today. Enjoy your weekend. Hope everybody viewing does as well. And we will see you 2 weeks from today.
All right. Bye, everyone.